Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuned in live to Tribe Family Channel's debut of A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee, Jr., author, military kid. Let me tell you a little bit about Bernard N. Lee, Jr. He is the author of A Look Back in Time. He is the oldest son of a career veteran of the U.S. Army. Together with his two sisters, Bernadine and Almanetta, and his brother, Mercer, he traveled throughout the United States and Europe during his childhood. The places he traveled, the people he met, and the stories he remembers are shared in this sequel to his memoir. These stories of a military kid in the 50s took place during his dad's three-year tour of duty in the U.S. Army in Germany. Bernie, as his friends call him, grew up in the 50s and 60s when the United States was experiencing the aftermath of World War II and the Korean conflict. That historical period shaped many of the perceptions that we have today of shared sacrifice and love for our country during times of war. Those times had a profound impact on his family and his father's career in the U.S. Army. They also shaped the personal perspective of the author. They also shaped the personal perspective the author has of his childhood and the memories of the places he lived and the people he met. Now, let's examine the 1950s. Before we bring you Mr. Bernard N. Lee, I'm going to take this from the internet, from history.com. The 50s were about more than just poodle skirts and rock and roll. America at this moment set the former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill in 1945 stands at the summit of the world. During the 1950s, it was easy to see what Churchill meant. The United States was the world's strongest military power. Its economy was booming, and the fruits of this prosperity, new cars, suburban houses, and other consumer goods were available to more people than ever before. However, the 1950s also had, the 1950s were also an era of great conflict. For example, the nascent civil rights movement and the crusade against communism at home and abroad exposed the underlying divisions in American society. The post-war booms. Historians use the word boom to describe a lot of things about the 1950s, the booming economy, the booming suburbs, and most of all, the so-called baby boom. This boom began in 1946 when a record number of babies, 3.4 million, were born in the United States. About 4 million babies were born each year during the 1950s. In all, by the time the boom finally tapered off in 1964, there were almost 77 million baby boomers. When Rosa Parks died in 2005, she was the first woman to lie in honor in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. After World War II ended, many Americans were eager to have children because they were confident that the future held nothing but peace and prosperity. In many ways, they were right. Between 1945 and 1960, the gross national product more than doubled, growing from $200 billion to more than $500 billion. Much of this increase came from government spending. The construction of interstate highways and schools, the distribution of veterans' benefits, and most of all, the increase in military spending on goods like airplanes and new technologies like computers all contributed to the decade's economic growth. Rates of unemployment and inflation were low and wages were high. Middle-class people had more money to spend than ever, and because the variety and availability of consumer goods expanded along with the economy, they also had more things to buy. We are going to hear from Mr. Bernard N. Lee Jr. because he has a story, a look back in time that is going to paint a picture for us over the next three episodes. This is a three-part series. We are going to find out what it was like for him growing up as a military child. Now, let me just say something about the civil rights movement in the 50s, and then I will turn it over to Bernard N. Lee Jr. for this episode of A Look Back in Time. A growing group of Americans spoke out against inequality and injustice during the 1950s. African Americans had been fighting against racial discrimination for centuries. During the 1950s, however, the struggle against racism and segregation entered the mainstream of American life. For example, in 1954, in the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case, the Supreme Court declared that separate educational facilities for black children were inherently unequal. This ruling was the first nail in Jim Crow's coffin. Many Southern whites resisted the Brown ruling. They withdrew their children from public schools and enrolled them in all-white segregation academies, and they used violence and intimidation to prevent blacks from asserting their rights. In 1956, more than 100 Southern congressmen even signed a Southern Manifesto declaring that they would do all they could to defend segregation. Despite these efforts, a new movement was born. In December 1955, a Montgomery activist named Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to give her seat on a city bus to a white person. Her arrest sparked a 13-month boycott of the city's buses by its black citizens, which only ended when the bus companies stopped discriminating against African-American passengers. acts of nonviolent resistance, like the boycott, helped shape the civil rights movement of the next decade. Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuned into A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee Jr. I will now yield the mic to the man of the hour. Welcome, Bernard.
Well, thank you, Beverly, and thank all the people who are listening in to the Tribe Family Network. I'm very pleased to be on your network. I'm very pleased to get a chance to share my book with all the listeners. And that opening gave me a lot to mull over. So what I'm going to do is, for the period that we have the mic, I'm going to share with you a look back in time from the viewpoint of a military kid, a kid whose father was in the service in the U.S. Army during the 1950s, early 60s. So, who was Bernard N. Lee Jr.? My dad was an Army sergeant. He enlisted in the Marines at 15, 16 years old. He lied about his age to get in. That was during the war, during World War II. He came out of the Marines a few years later, could not get comparable employment as a civilian, and reenlisted in the Army. It's from that point where I was born in Virginia, Big Island, Virginia, and I spent my life on the farm with my grandmother and the life that she knew at that time in the early days after the Great Depression. So let's take a look at life on the farm, because I want you to know how our family evolved and what they thought of the Mitchells, because that's what our family name was. The Mitchells were a resourceful, well-respected, and proud Negro family. Grandpa Mitchell owned a farm and, by most people's standards, did all right for himself. He raised hogs, chickens, planted corn and potatoes, and hired himself out as a handyman when he could. During good times, he worked at the sawmill a few miles down the river from the farm, and during hard times, he sold honey from the oak tree boughs, caught possum, squirrels, rabbits, and slaughtered hogs for the few white folks who could still afford to raise them. Biddy was his nickname, and people said that his word was as good as gold. I learned all of this from listening to my mom talk about her father. Biddy was a proud black man. He had a reputation for fairness, but he packed a gun when necessary. He had a temper, which he did his best to contain, and a shrewdness, which helped him survive when his temper flared. He had very little formal education. He really didn't spend much time reading the Bible. He cursed. He swigged his liquor with the best of them. If times got hard, he crossed the railroad tracks with his cane pole over his shoulder, trekked down a well-worn path that ended beside a boulder of Virginia granite, slumped down, cast out, lay back, and let the good Lord do his fishing. Although I never had the chance to know my grandpa, I loved him. I cherished all the wonderful things my mother told me about him. I was only 5 years old when he died. That was my beginning as a child on a farm in Virginia. Maybe you've lost a grandparent or have an uncle or aunt whom you've never met. Maybe you have a father or mother who's always gone. If so, then you know how important it is to learn as much as you can about them. My grandpa was very special to me. I had pictures of him, but I wasn't able to touch him or walk with him by my side. Still, I have a strong memory of all that he stood for, and that has served me well. Grandpa Mitchell lived during hard times. He lived during the Great Depression, the aftermath after the 1930s depression. If you have grandparents that are alive today, they can probably tell you about it. Millions of people lost their jobs. Thousands of people found themselves homeless. Many thousands more waited for hours in block-long bread lines outside of soup kitchens just to get something to eat. Unfortunately, if this scenario sounds too familiar, it's because the entire world recently suffered through a similar financial meltdown like the one in the 1930s. We call the most recent one the Great Recession. But history does repeat itself if you don't learn the lesson. I was not there to see the Great Depression of the 30s, but the fallout from the stock market crash rippled across the country for years afterwards. I remember walking along the railroad tracks and wishing I could follow the train to faraway places. No one has ever lived near the railroad tracks didn't forget that feeling. No matter how young or old you are, the whistle of the train can work its magic and awaken a desire in you, in your heart, to hop on board for an adventure. I found a whole new world walking along that latest highway. In the middle of the day, the quarry rocks were warm and treacherous. So I walked across the railroad tracks to go fishing the same way my grandfather had done when he was a young boy. We scurried along the tracks picking up the pieces of precious black gold, looking for hidden treasures that might have fallen off the train as it traveled to and from faraway places. The black gold was coal. We would run along the railroad tracks with a bucket, and we'd pick up coal. We'd take it back so that my grandmother could use it to fire up the stove to cook. On some days when the train passed with hitchhiking hobos on board, these were usually men who rode the train from town to town to get work. We would toss potatoes, apples, or pears to them, and the men would kick pockets of coal overboard for us to gather. They'd be sitting on the coal car, and so they'd kick a few lumps of coal off for us to gather. If you ever shared your lunch with someone who's obviously hungry, then you know the warm feeling you get by helping someone who's truly in need. That's how we felt by throwing an apple up to a homeless person riding a coal car on a train. My mother was the youngest girl in her family. She remembers her childhood fondly. Her father was a resourceful man. He managed to fend off starvation and do quite well for himself during the Depression. The Mitchells were a fortunate family. That's what my mother told me. Why is this important? Because who am I? I'm the son of a woman who traveled for more than 27 years with a man who moved every 3 years. So the grasp I had of security, resilience, strength, came from my mother, who told me about her family, who didn't travel, who stayed at home in Virginia, but who had done all right for themselves. Grandpa Mitchell had farm animals, and I remember him milking the cow, or my mother telling me about him milking the cow, until they had to sell it to pay their debts. I also remember my mother telling me the story about her working in a neighbor's house who had money for people who did day work, and she would iron clothes, she would clean the house, and at the end of the day, the neighbor would give her a choice. You could have $5 or you could have a pound of butter. When they lost their cow, they could no longer churn the milk to get butter, so she would always take the butter. If you're a teenager and you've worked to earn a little money, you know how proud you are when you get paid. My mother was proud to get a pound of butter to help feed her family, but she still remembers to this day that she never got pocket change like the other teenagers did because they didn't have a cow. and she had to work for the butter. That's a little bit about a look back in time early on the farm. Beverly.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. I remember a lot about my grandfather from my mother. I think that's quite common that young boys don't have all of the support that they might want to have. My grandparents did not live very long, so I only knew my grandmother a very short time and my grandfather basically not at all, because he died when I was about 5 weeks old. So the stories that are passed along by our elders are very important, and they help strengthen you as you go forward, as you face challenges in the world. And there were challenges.
What I'm hearing is just so important, because you are able to pass along the knowledge of your grandparents, though you did not have, you know, all of that time that some may have had to spend with them. I did not know any of my grandfathers, such as yourself. My grandfather passed the year I was born, and I was very close to my grandmother. So hearing you go back in time and just bring forward the gems and the lessons and the survival skills, the hobos dropping the coal off the train and the trade-off that it takes to survive during different times of eras of war, and not just war, but depression and economical strain, people find creative ways of surviving. And it's very interesting to hear you talk about the hobos. For our listening audience, you are tuned into A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee Jr. He is an author and military kid. Looking back over his life, he has a two-part series, A Look Back in Time, he has two books that he is going over. This is a three-part series in which we are walking through that period of time. I would like to share with our audience, before I turn the mic back over to you, additional information for those that, just to bridge the gap. You were talking about the hobos and train hopping. Freight hopping or train hopping is the act of boarding and riding a railroad freight car. In the United States, this became a common means of transportation following the American Civil War, as the railroads began pushing westward, especially among migrant workers who became known as hobos. It continued to be widely used by those unable to afford other transportation, especially during times of widespread economic dislocation, such as the Great Depression. And then for a variety of reasons, the practice is less common today, but however, freight train riders still exist. And just to hear you go over that period of time of survival, it's amazing. And we spoke earlier about Booker T. Washington and him and Rosenthal and the creation of the YWCA, because the way in which travel and survival and post-war depression and the way it was for people of color, the landscape was a lot different from the excerpts that you heard me read at the beginning of this show. And so this conversation is to really illustrate the polarities of these times. You know, we talk about the economic boom, but we're hearing that we had hobos riding cars being thrown apples and dropping coal off. So look at the polarity from the opening of this show through a look back in time with Bernard N. Lee Jr. and just how surviving and bridging that information in between. This is so very important, Bernard, and I want to thank you once again. Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuned into A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee Jr., and I want to turn the mic back over to you, Bernard.
Okay, thank you, Beverly. During that period, my grandmother was alive, and she formed another pillar of strength for our family. Grandma was an early riser. She started the fire that warmed all of us in the morning. She also heated the water for our baths at night. She was a resourceful person who canned everything from apricots to peaches. She was a wonderful cook. She baked pound cakes that had our mouths watering. She made homemade biscuits that floated molasses and steered fatback oars all over our plates. Grandma Mitchell was a tireless worker. She toiled long after others stopped to rest. She was up before the rooster crowed and didn't go to bed until after the moon turned over to fall asleep. If you were lucky enough to have a grandmother like Grandma Mitchell, then you know how magically she makes everything look so easy and turn out so well. I was too young to recall much about my grandma, but I treasure every story my mom told me about her. She was a righteous, proud, intelligent, resourceful, and strong Earth Mother. That's what we call Earth Mothers. She was a guiding light for my mother that showed through the strength and determination that all the Mitchells possessed. By watching my mother persevere through a half century of her own life, I have come to know my grandmother well. I believe my mother learned a lot from Grandma Mitchell, who carried herself with quiet confidence that comes from believing in yourself and God. Both women were strong Earth Mothers, whose lives were a testament to the strength that inner peace provides. They sincerely believed in the power of positive thinking and the miracle of prayer. They were honest to a fault and would fret for hours over the least hint of an impropriety or a wrongdoing towards their fellow man. They lived to serve and took pride in a job well done. They cared tirelessly for their children and comforted their men when they came home from a hard day's work. They told wonderful fairy tales and read stories from the good book. They made do with little or nothing, seemed to take pride in how well they managed their homes, their families, and their adversity. Both were proud and resourceful. Like all Earth Mothers before them, they were truly the cornerstones of our civilization. No man enters this earth without being graced by their labor and touched by their gifts. For their many sacrifices, may God bless them one and all. That was a passage about my grandmother and my mother and the bond that they had and the stories that she passed on to me. I had a chore that I did for my mom when we lived in Maryland. I was in the elementary school at that time, and I had a bicycle. And I used to ride up the hill from where we lived on Reed Street there in Maryland, in Hyattsville, Maryland. And I would ride up the hill to the Wonder Bread Bakery. At that time, you could go to the Wonder Bread Bakery like you go to Krispy Kreme Donuts. You could get day-old bread, which was basically fresh bread that had just been baked that very same day. And I would get that day-old bread. I'd stop at the ice cream parlor and get my mother a pint of peach ice cream, which was her favorite. And then I would ride my bicycle back down the hill to our home. I always had a challenge trying to ride up the hill and back. At that time, we had dogs who were friendly to some and not so friendly to others. and they lived on our street. And, of course, they loved to chase cars, and they loved to chase bicycles. On this particular day, I'm riding down the hill. I've got my bread. I've got my ice cream. I'm riding with no hands because that's what we guys did then. And I'm balancing it all in my lap, and a dog comes to chase me. And he gets caught in the front wheel, and I tumble. I spill the ice cream. I crush the bread. I'm as mad as can be. But now I'm really worried because I have to go home, and I have to explain to my father, this military man, what I was sent to do, I failed at. And I have to explain to my mother that she wasn't going to have her peach ice cream this afternoon, and that there was no bread for our lunches for the next day, except that which I was able to scrape up off the pavement. It was those challenges that caused me to decide I would try my best to do something about the dogs that chased me in the neighborhood. The very next day, we're playing outside in front of the house on the sidewalk, and we're roller skating. And I'm roller skating down with a group of other kids, and this big chow comes running across the road, barking and snarling and chasing all of the kids and scattered them. I took off down the sidewalk, and the dog took off after me. He got close enough to nip my heels, and I tumbled face forward myself on the ground and on the sidewalk. And the dog, when I hollered, yelped, turned, and ran back across the street and back to the house where it came from. My sister, who was a year younger than I was, came running after me, and she asked, "Are you okay?" And the first thing out of my mouth was, "He bit me." Well, that sent an alarm out. If you've ever been bitten by a dog, you know two things. One, it probably hurts. Two, you know that the dog has to have been tested and has to have been found rabies-free, and has to have a collar or something that certifies that, or you have to take a series of shots, which are very painful, to prove that you're free of rabies, which can be a deadly dilemma. My parents took me to the military hospital. They checked me out. I think the physician was smart enough to realize that I probably hadn't been bitten, but I did have a very nasty scar. They did not require that I take the shots that you would take if they were worried that I would get rabies. But my dad was very upset about what he heard about the dog chasing us, the kids on the block. That evening, I walked with my dad over to our neighbor's house across the street. My dad knocked on the door, and the neighbor opened the door. My dad got through the niceties. "How are you? We're across the street. I'm glad, to know you." And then he spoke what he came to speak. He said, "I understand that your dog chased the kids and that he bit at my son. I had to take him to the hospital. I don't expect this to occur again." And my dad was a man of few words. And the words that he uttered after that were scary for me. Because he said, "If I see the dog chasing my kids again out on my lot, I'll kill him." I had never heard those words before come out of my dad's mouth. I did not realize that he could be such a serious person. What he was conveying was, it's serious business if my kid could die from rabies, from a dog that bites him, and I take that job seriously to the point where I'm going to explain to you how seriously I take it. After that, I was very careful not to get into that type of situation. But I was also very thankful that I had a father who would stand up for me with that much gusto and with that much bravery. And that was in Maryland when we were in elementary school. And that was a story for a look back in time, memoir of a military kid in the 50s.
So intriguing, so very intriguing. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuned in to A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee, Jr., author, military kid. The illustrations of that period in which you grew up are so vividly and profoundly displayed, and I am very curious to know, what did it feel like once you saw how serious your father was about being the protector? How did that change for you in terms of growth and responsibility and becoming a man and a protector yourself, after you saw how serious he was?
I took that particular incident very soberly. I realized that my dad was a military man, that he was a man of few words, but that he was used to being a man of action. I can say honestly that most military kids, most military children have a very high respect, high regard for their military parent. You are told that if you get in trouble and if it gets reported, that your trouble reflects on your parent. And in fact, if you get in trouble and it's serious, it could reflect on the rank and the ability of your parent to move up through the ranks. So there was a linkage there. There was a linkage there. My father had to do his job so that the military would reward him and continue to advance him. We, as military kids, were expected to toe the mark, to stay in line, to follow orders, to be respectful, and to realize that every single thing we did could come back on our military parent. So I understood when my dad said what he said, that he was serious. There were consequences.
Right.
There were consequences. And so my dad's thing was to convey to someone he was dealing with, now let me tell you what the consequences are going to be if we can't resolve this in an amiable way. And I believe that.
You're living within the military, and there are so many worlds unfolding, because civilian life during the Jim Crow era, World War II, Korean conflict, post-war, post-Civil War, post-all wars, post-Vietnam, post-war, period. And there's a set of values that you have to adhere to from a military standpoint, but then we're also living in the Jim Crow era, and there's a black and white world. There's an economical divide. There's a color divide, a racial divide. And your family is able to matriculate and navigate for your family a life where, although you do know how it is to, you know, not have all the luxuries of life, when you talk about throwing fruit up to the hobos and them kicking down coal, you also have the benefit of your father growing through the ranks of the military and living on the bases and being able to go to school and just trying to being able to navigate through a period of time where blacks were definitely having a hard time in terms of, again, the Jim Crow era, racism. When you look at the Civil Rights Movement, when you look at Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, when you look at the 1961 era of the Mississippi Tougaloo Nine sit-ins, and when you just look at history in itself as it translates across that period of time, there's a plethora of layers to where we can take this conversation. So I'm so glad that you have vividly painted the picture of where you get your values, from whence the people and the ancestors that you have come from, and how your family embraces those values. Now, I want you also, before we run out of time coming up to the top of the hour, to tell us, because we're still in the family aspects of your childhood, and
right.
I want to allow our listeners also see into that period of time when you were going to school as a child and catching the bus and the differences in the racial divide and the segregation of that period of time, even though, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can cover that. You mentioned the 1954 decision by the courts to desegregate schools. I was in Georgia in 1955. And interesting, we lived on post then in a barracks-like environment where there were four units. And the unit downstairs, we lived upstairs in on the right side in the upstairs unit. The downstairs unit on the left was an Irish family. Downstairs unit on the right was a Hispanic family. Upstairs next to our unit was an Italian family, and we all lived in the same building on post. We played marbles together. We played baseball together. We wrestled. We ran. We had a great time during the summer. So it came time to go to fifth grade. We were in Augusta, Georgia, at Fort Gordon. And we got up early that morning, my sister and I, and we went to the bus stop with all the people we'd been playing with during the summer. We got to the bus stop where all the kids were milled around, and a kid looked at me and said, "What are you doing here?" And I looked at my sister and I wondered why he singled me out. And then he said, "This isn't your bus stop. Your bus stop's down there." And he pointed to the other corner. And he said, "And by the way, your bus is just leaving." In a panic, I grabbed my sister's hand, and we ran to catch our bus. There happened to be a kid on the bus looking out the back window. He saw us running. He told the driver. The driver stopped, and we were able to get on. The bus took us off the post, across town, through farmland, out to a large clearing, and there was this big, beautiful, magnificent, brand new school. I had never seen anything so magnificent in my elementary years. And that's where we went to school, my sister and I, in the fifth grade in Georgia. We got back home from school that day. We got off our bus on one corner. Our military friends got off their bus on the other corner. We turned and ran toward each other, locked arms, and walked back home. That was the military version of the mid-50s, after schools were desegregated. In this particular instance, they had not been desegregated in Augusta. However, we went to Texas, and in Texas, we stayed on the post. We went in the sixth grade to school on post. The schools were desegregated or integrated on post. And it seemed just normal. Why? Because we were all military kids. The separation in the military is by rank. You're an enlisted person or you're an officer, and you have a certain rank. And the rank gives you certain privileges and a certain command. And people understand that. They operate by that. So when someone says we're all the same, what they're meaning is we're military. We're all enlistees, or we're all officers, or we're all a military corps. We're all the same. I had an incident where we were outside in physical education. We were running tag games, you know, where you run around, down around the peg and come back and tag the next person and they run. And we had started this game and with a class that I had not seen before. The school was large, and apparently all of the physical ed classes were put together on this particular day. And so the team we were running against, they were new to me. These kids were new to me. I'm running, and there's a kid who's slightly ahead of me, and he you know, rounds the peg before I do, but I'm right behind him. And he looks over his shoulder, and he yells, "Last one back is a," and he says the N-word. Now, I had heard that word before, but I had never heard that word uttered on a military post in school addressed to me from another military kid. I think I lost it. I think just momentarily it just got under my skin. So when we got back to the point for the end of the race, we stopped. I went over to the kid. He turned around and looked at me, and I just punched him. I probably should not have done that. I know my dad and my mom would not have wanted me to do that, but it just was something in me that said, you didn't have a right to call me a word in a contest because you thought you could. The other kids looked at me in amazement. And one of the kids said to the sergeant, because we have a sergeant for a physical education teacher, "Sarge, are you going to, you see what he did?" And then what happened next was amazing to me and very enlightening. The sergeant looked at the kid who'd fallen on the ground or been knocked on the ground, and he said, and he looked at the other kids that were standing around, and he said, "Serves him right. He shouldn't have said what he said. We're all military, and we're all the same." The kid got up off the ground. He dusted himself off. He said, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean what I said. I didn't mean to offend. I said I accept your apology." And we went on from there. But I learned something. Equity in the military was different than equity in off posts in the civilian environment. And that was a telling thing for me, because it told me that when I went off post into the civilian environment, I'd have to be a little bit more cautious. I'd have to take a little bit more care. And that was how it was in the mid-50s. The first time I went to a desegregated school, Oklahoma, this was in Lawton, Oklahoma. The schools in Lawton, Oklahoma were desegregated around 1956, 57, and I was in the seventh grade, and I went to Central Junior High School. Lawton, Oklahoma is where Fort Sill, Oklahoma exists. It's a large military post, and most of the people in the town at the time worked on posts. And at this day, in time, many, many, many still do work on post. The school had been desegregated because each student came with a dollar value that they carried as a military kid. It was around $525 to $575 a kid, which in the mid-50s was a lot of money.
There's a lot of money today, too, if you're talking to me.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You know.
So the town had a decision to make. Do we take these military kids and let them go to this school, all of them, and treat them all the same, or do we say no? They took the money and they desegregated the school. Now let's see what happened in return. The military was instrumental, I believe, in not only enriching the town that decided to make that compromise and follow the law, but they assisted in building a new high school, a brand new high school in town. And they designated, they had two posts that you go into. These are gates that you go into to get on the military post, gate one, gate two. And they were separated by all of these roads that maybe a couple of miles apart. Everyone that were on the west side of the road that went into gate two went to the new high school. Everyone on the east side of the road that went into gate two went to the established high school, which was Lawton High School. That compromise turned out to be a really great compromise because at the same time, the African-American school, Douglas High School, which had K through 12 going to their school, and, you know, they were spilling over because it hadn't been expanded in years, those students were permitted then to go to Lawton High School. And so the rivalry became Lawton High School versus Eisenhower High School. And it wasn't you can't be here because you came from Douglas High School and you can't be at my school, Lawton High School. No, you play football, you play basketball, you run track. Are you any good? Good. We're on the same team. And that team intends to beat who? The new high school, Eisenhower.
Let me have you pin that. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to have you pin that right there as we come up to the top of the hour, approaching the conclusion of this segment, this first in our three-part series of A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee, Jr., author/military kid. The thing that I would like to ask you, when you were called the N-word, now this is someone that you play with, but the household in which you're growing up have two different messages. This person felt comfortable saying that until he learned otherwise. And this is what has to be explored, the conversations that are being had at home, the conversations that took place back then, and the conversations that are happening or that we can perceive that are taking place today. And the racial disparities, polarities, and the trends that continue in today's times, that will encompass our next conversation on A Look Back in Time. What I would like to know from you, what do you think would have happened? I have two questions. What do you think would have happened had you not been on, or had you not been a military kid, had you been considered
had I been
a civilian?
Town? Had I been in town?
Had you been
yeah.
in town and had mm-hmm. you been called that in under the same circumstances in that same period of time? And then secondly, I would like to know Do you or have you ever perceived that the military cushioned you, and did you get any blowback from other black and brown kids of color growing up?
Well, I'll answer the second question. The answer is yes. The military did shield us military kids, from much of the problems that occurred in local towns. Very often we were quarantined, meaning we had to stay on post. We were not allowed off post during periods of disturbances. So in that case, yes, the military did shield us. We were looked at as military kids, meaning you were military kids first, and you were anything else afterwards, later, behind that. So you learned to stick together because you learned that that was the way you were expected to operate and that that's the way you could survive. Now, had I been called the N-word in town, I would have had to have a totally different response. And I apologize, for a young kid with a temper is not the best. That's not the best at any time, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And I gradually grew out of that. I gradually learned, as they said, to speak your words and not use your fists. And I'm glad that I did. In town, you would be expelled. You'd be put out of school maybe for 3 years or three days to 5 days. If you got into a fight, and especially if you threw the first punch. And so I would have responded differently. I might have said something like, I'll get you later, but it wouldn't have been at school, and it wouldn't have been in town. So, yes, I knew the difference. I understood the difference. That was what took me back. I had not expected anything like that to occur on a military post. Not, absolutely not. And the young man learned a very important lesson. The military didn't expect it either. And that lesson, I hope, and I'm pretty certain he took with him the rest of his life, that it's not cool to lose your cool and take it out on someone else, especially when you try to denigrate them in doing it.
Well, I like the way you so eloquently put that. I'm going to translate for street vernacular. White people do not have permission to call black people the N-word, and that's about as light as I'm going to put it for Tribe Family Channel, but there is not a blanket pass for that level of degradation. And though now in today's culture, N-I-G-G-A, never ignorant, getting goals accomplished, is the acronym that Tupac, rest in peace, my brother from another, both born June 16th, days are coming up. Never ignorant, getting goals accomplished. N-I-G-G-A, never ignorant, getting goals accomplished. Today, the vernacular and the slang is embraced, and it includes words that back in those days were and still will get you beat up. Basically, like you said, he learned, you learned, and it will still get you beat up. There are just things that you cannot say and do, and it is a cultural thing among black and brown folk. And there's, you know, things in other cultures, it's understood among different cultures. It's just part of life. I want to thank you so very, very much for giving us the precursor to delving deeper into the landscape of racism and how it plays out or how it has been playing out across the landscape of America. As we take a look back in time through your publications, we can build an understanding and a perception between life for you, life for the average civilian growing up black during those times. And you were absolutely buffered because we're talking about the Jim Crow era, and your family is able to create a life for you, to create a legacy that a foundation to build upon. It's not easy for blacks during these times. It's not easy during those times. It's not easy during these times, because much of what blacks suffered from racism wise during those times are still prevalent during these times. And so it is at this time, as we come up to the top of the hour and get ready to close out the show, that I would like to again offer this perspective. And this is from May 27th, 2013, an author by the name of Kimmy Mabrook. And this is entitled Racism Against Black People in the 1950s and 60s. So it says, racism against blacks in the 1950s and 60s, Jim Crow racial segregation. Jim Crow was an executed social system devised by the ruling class. At times of economical crisis, the ruling class often used racism to divide working people. It is also used to drive down wages and working conditions, providing cheap labor. In the South, rights to vote, organize, even to assemble were taken away from blacks, segregated schools, transport, public toilets, etc., condemned blacks to the worst conditions. Blacks in America had to face a degrading, racist social system known as Jim Crow racial segregation, which were state and local laws in the United States World War II. Taking away the rights of blacks enabled people that owned land who were short on labor to force them to work for extremely low wages before the war. Black ghettos we see today were made from the migration of blacks after the war. 3 million black people registered for the army, and the ones that returned came back prepared to fight for change. 1954 Supreme Court ruling. Throughout Africa and Asia, there were huge movements for independence against military and economic domination by imperialism. This was the reason for the 1954 Supreme Court ruling that deemed segregation in schools illegal. Lynchings. The Southern Democratic Party, made up of white small property owners, still followed the Jim Crow system and had to exploit blacks to make profit. Lynchings became a part of the Jim Crow system. Many people traveled for miles to see the lynching of a black take place. Discounts were offered at railroads for those traveling to a lynching. Rallies with the Democratic Party speakers were held before some lynchings took place, and photographs of the events were even taken and sold as souvenirs. Montgomery bus boycott, December 1955. Rosa Parks, an activist in the National Association for the Advancement of Black People, but it's really the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, but I'm reading from this article. This is when Rosa Parks made her stand. They used her case to organize one-day boycott of the buses. The whole black community rallied behind the boycott. Boycott went on from one day to almost a year. Initially, the campaign demanded sensitive treatment for blacks on buses. They realized they had to also end segregation on buses. violence spiraled, and during the campaign, at least 8 bombings took place. The Ku Klux Klan killed many black people, sit-ins, and freedom rides. In the 1960s, younger kids wanted to make a change. They would enter lunch bars and demand to be served, and when refused, they would sit in. Police would be called, and the youth would be arrested. Many were beaten. Every time a group was arrested, another group would come to take their place. Then came the Freedom Riders, where black students would board buses and travel through the southern states. These actions were taken to force the integration of buses that had already been passed in law. Many of the Freedom Riders were beaten and brutalized by racist mobs. Martin Luther King Jr., to sustain the Jim Crow system lynchings and murders, became known. Blacks who registered to vote were assassinated, and many blacks that fought for their rights in any way were terrorized. Now, that is someone else's summary, but it is so vivid of a description of those times, save for there may be some editorial mistakes and probably a language barrier. But for the most part, you get out of what I just read just how hard it was to be black in America during the 50s. Being black in America during the 50s would get you killed.
It was a challenge. There's no doubt about it. It was a challenge. That challenge did at times spill over to the military, in particular in Germany, when troops there were restless after going downtown on a weekend, partying with the ladies, spending their money, which the Americans had a lot of, and so there were a lot of people there waiting to entertain so that they could get some of that money. And disagreements did occur, and very often the harshness toward the blacks who were involved in those was obvious. To get through that period, the military did a lot of changing, and in many instances, it was ahead of the general society in the regulations and rules that were instituted to change. But it wasn't an easy road at all. It involved a lot of struggles, and for people who went overseas and found that they weren't held. That they were held in better regard overseas sometimes than they'd ever felt at home. That although they looked a little different and therefore people were a little curious about them, they didn't treat them from sight badly. They didn't expect them to walk on the other side of the street. They didn't expect them to bow their heads as they passed. They didn't expect them to follow any of those Jim Crow laws. And if there was any challenging of that, it was on the part of people, of Americans who came from various parts of the country, and they brought with them those traditions and those memories and those recent uprisings that had been held. They brought that with them to them when they went overseas. In the second book that I wrote, it's about the time that we spent in Germany. I've got one thing I'd like to tell you about the trip. On our way from Oklahoma to New York, where we were going to fly out on the plane to go to Germany for the 3 years that my dad had been stationed there, we encountered the fact that there were no hotels and motels that people of color could stop to stay in. And so if you didn't know someone in the town where you were traveling to, and if you didn't know someone in a town in between the towns you were traveling through, you had to live in your car. You lived out of your car. You didn't go to the bathroom during the day because the service stations were not desegregated in many places, and so you had to hold your water until late at night when it was dark, or you had to find a stand of trees where you could disappear into the stand of trees to go. And that was common for people who were in the military traveling to get to their next destination, where you were usually given about a week to 2 weeks to do that. And you had to do that on your own. So we were in the car in Tennessee on our way to Virginia, on our way to New York via Virginia, and we parked at the top of the hill on a big curve. And, of course, we stepped out to go to the bathroom, my sister, my mother first, and then myself and my brother. And I realized when I stepped that I only had about another foot and a half to go, and I would have gone over the cliff. There were no railings. There were no guardrails on that section of highway where we parked. When we woke up in the morning, I looked for our dad, and he was gone. I asked my mom, so where's Dad? And she said he's gone into town to see if he can get us something to eat. I didn't have to ask why did Dad leave me here and not take me with him. And I didn't have to ask Dad why didn't we drive into town and just stop to get something to eat. Because that's not how we were able to operate in the mid-50s. So my dad had been gone for a couple of hours. We began to worry. After about 3 hours, we were really worried. After the fourth hour, we wondered if he was going to come back at all. I tried to stay strong for my sisters, and I tried to stay strong for my mom. So I tried not to ask any embarrassing questions, and I tried not to seem too unsettled myself. That worked for a little while. But as the time wore on, it was harder and harder to do. I noticed a gentleman, well, I call him a gentleman, but a figure of a man, way down at the bottom of the hill around a hairpin curve. And he was walking up the mountain toward the traffic. And I couldn't tell who it was, and I couldn't make out whether it was my dad or not, but I hoped it was. As he went by behind a stand of trees that were in my view, I couldn't see him at all. And I really began to worry then that if it wasn't my dad, maybe it was somebody who was just traveling on their own who might give us a hard time. As he came out from behind the stand of trees, I could see him a little bit better. I could make him out a little bit easier. And I realized it was my dad. As he walked up the hill, he seemed like he might be a little tired, but very determined. He had two sacks, one in each arm, and he was walking at a brisk pace. My mom noticed that I had spotted something, and she said, what did you see? And I said, I think Dad's coming. And about then, she looked out the window, and she could see him too. We literally cheered in the car. He was safe, and he had done what he set out to do, which was to get something to eat for his family for the next few days. He brought back fried chicken. He brought back French fries. He brought back milk for my mom and the baby, my sister, Almanita. And we all celebrated in the car, eating this breakfast lunch with our dad. That was what you had to go through when you traveled in the middle 50s, even if you were in the military.
Wow. What I would like to do is invite our listeners to return to part two, July 5th of A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee, Jr., and this conversation will resume where we left off right here as it relates to traveling while black during the 50s and the 60s, as it relates to a segment of history that brings us to why the YWCA and Booker T. Washington intersected, blacks traveling in the United States, Jim Crow era, a look back in time with Bernard N. Lee Jr. I almost said doctor, so let me speak over you. With Dr. Bernard N. Lee Jr., author / military kid. Now, where can our listeners find you and pick up your fascinating work?
You can find me on www.BernardLeeJr.com, BernardLeeJr.com. That's my website. You can read about both books on that website. You can order a copy on the website. You can email me if you want a signed copy. And thank you, Beverly, for giving me a chance to share that information with our listeners.
It is my honor, privilege, and pleasure. I want to thank you for sponsoring your three-part series here, A Look Back in Time with Bernard N. Lee Jr. This is a fascinating story, a look back in history, and we're going to conclude with this song by Etta James titled Trust in Me. And I think it speaks volumes for your father as he provided for his family and having that trust in him and his family, you know, just knowing that they're going to be all right. Trust in me. Thank you, Bernard.
Thank you, Beverly, and Tribe Family Network. Family Channel.
Trust in me in all you do. Have the faith I have in you. Love will see us through if only you trust in me. Cling to me, Daddy. Oh, yeah, and I'll be strong. We can get along, we can get along. Oh, if only you trust in me. Why don't you smile? Trust in me, and I'll be worthy of you. Oh, yeah, yeah. Why don't you? Your trust in me, and all. Come to me when things